I want to welcome you to the 11th lesson in this verse-by-verse series through the book of Zechariah, brought to you by Mission 119 Ministries. This series is titled Looking Forward, Living Now. More detailed notes are available in the book Looking Forward, Living Now, available on Amazon. Our text today is Zechariah chapter 10, and the title of this lesson is New Exodus. And I'll just say by way of introduction before we get going in this lesson that there's a lot of debate about future things, about eschatology, and I'll suggest to you that a lot of those debates wouldn't happen if people knew their Old Testament better. The New Testament speaks in the language of the Old Testament, and especially in the book of Revelation, where people try to draw most of their eschatology from. And the book of Zechariah especially, as I've suggested in some of the prior lessons, does not get its due attention. And yet it answers many of the questions such as, you know, will the tribulation occur before or after the rapture? Will there be a millennial kingdom? If you understand the book of Zechariah well, I think the answers to those questions are rather obvious, even as you get to the New Testament passages that you have to interpret. So that's just an aside. It's not our purpose here to deal with a systematic approach to eschatology. What we're trying to do is a biblical theological approach to the book of Zechariah. But just have that in mind as you go through this important study of Zechariah to try to meld in what it says against what you believe the Bible says as a whole about the end times. It will change what a lot of people believe if you give credence to what Zechariah says and allow Zechariah to speak for itself. So with that said, let's move into this lesson. The name Zechariah means God remembers. He remembers his people and his promises to them. Over and again, Zechariah's messages remind the Jewish remnant in need of what I would call good words and comfortable words. And I'm quoting from chapter 1, verse 13. He reminds them that God remembers. The book shows us the nation of Israel physically and spiritually revitalized in a glorious future where the promised Messiah lives in Jerusalem, transforming the nation and indeed transforming the world. But in Zechariah's day, only a remnant returned home after the Babylonian captivity. While others would come to this present time, most of the Jewish people remain scattered among the nations. We have a lot of Jewish people in the United States. But for the promised future blessing Zechariah presents to the people to be realized, there must be a future regathering of the Jewish people back to the promised land. This central theme, that is an exodus from the nations, is therefore prominent in Zechariah's ministry. We saw that in chapter 2, verses 6 to 7. And again in chapter 8, verses 7 to 8. But at this point in Zechariah 10, the prophet elaborates on this new exodus from the Gentile nations back to Israel. It seems impossible in Zechariah's day, and even more so today, that the Jewish people scattered around the world would return to the promised land. Just as the original exodus from Egypt during the days of Moses required a people of faith, we read that in Hebrews 11, 29, so also there will be a future revival as God calls his people home. Now, despite the chapter break between chapters 9 and 10, we covered 9 in the last lesson, chapter 10 continues the same message, or as Zechariah would call it in Zechariah 9 verse 1, a burden from the Lord. But the focus changes here in chapter 10. Chapter 9 details the coming victory over Israel's enemies and the first and second comings of the king who will speak peace to the nations. Chapter 10, however, contrasts Israel's bad shepherds and consequent idolatry to the blessings to be experienced in the kingdom with God as shepherd as the scattered Jewish people are regathered to the Holy Land. Chapter 9 ends with Zechariah's statement of praise and a general description of the prosperity of the new age. Chapter 10 does not sequentially follow, but looks back to describe the new exodus of the Jewish people from the Gentile nations to the promised land, where they will reign with Messiah as he is installed as king. Most expositors spiritualize away all such prophecies. They deny a literal regathering of the Jewish people. But if we take the verses in a plain sense, God will restore the scattered nation to their land. And more than that, God wants to bless them in the land. So with this background in mind, let's turn to the passages at hand from Zechariah 10. And if you have your Bibles available to you, I encourage you to read along with me. We'll begin in Zechariah 10:1. Ask ye of the Lord rain in the time of the latter rain. So the Lord shall make bright clouds and give them showers of rain to everyone grass in the field. The burden that began in chapter 9 continues, but the focus changes from the coming king to the blessings to be experienced in the Messiah's kingdom. Now, for an agrarian culture, nothing speaks more blessings than rain. And under Messiah's leadership, rain will be available in abundance for the asking. Recall the promises of Deuteronomy chapter 11, and I'll read to you 11 verses 11 to 17. But the land, whither you go to possess it, is a land of hills and valleys, and drinketh water, the rain of heaven, a land which the Lord thy God careth for. The eyes of the Lord thy God are always upon it, from the beginning of the year even unto the end of the year. And it shall come to pass, if you shall hearken diligently unto my commandments, which I command you this day, to love the Lord your God, and to serve him with all your heart, with all your soul, that I will give you the rain of your land in his due season, the first rain and the latter rain, that thou mayest gather in thy corn and thy wine and thine oil. And I will send grass in thy fields for thy cattle, that thou mayest eat and be full. Take heed to yourselves, that your heart be not deceived, and ye turn aside and serve other gods and worship them. And then the Lord's wrath be kindled against you, and he shut up the heaven, and there shall be no rain, and that the land yield not her fruit, and lest you perish quickly from off the good land which the Lord giveth you. I know it's a long quote, but we need to capture this idea that was so fundamental to the thinking of the Jewish people, that in a time of blessing, God would bless the land and bless their agriculture. In their dispersion from the land as a consequence of their rebellion and their idolatry, the Jewish people lost these blessings, just as Moses warned them. The prophet Jeremiah said, "Are there among you the vanities of the Gentiles that can cause rain? Or can the heavens give showers? Art not thou he, O Lord our God? Therefore we will wait upon thee, for thou hast made all these things." Jeremiah 14:22. But with their return to the land, God implores them to ask for blessings so that he may bless them. Thus God says through Zechariah the prophet, "Ask ye of the Lord rain in the time of the latter rain." In response to this prayer and echoing the blessings of the Deuteronomy chapter 11 that I just read to you, the Lord shall make bright clouds, the text says, and give you showers of rain to everyone grass in the field. Israel's rainy seasons begin in October, that would be the early rain, and they end in March to May, that's the latter rain. The latter rains are associated with bringing the crops to maturity for the harvest. These showers of rain will grow the crops and the grass to feed the people and the livestock and thus provide material prosperity for the land. Now, I must point out that this verse, like so many in the book of Zechariah, is very much debated. Many expositors see a literal regathering to the land, but they view verse 1 figuratively. They construe the showers of rain as really just spiritual blessings. While I do not think the first verse should be understood as mere spiritual blessings, admittedly, the point of the text extends beyond crops. It shows a general prosperity in the land. And we must not lose sight of the focus on the provider of the blessings, who is contrasted with the idols they formerly trusted for showers of rain, that they now would turn to God and ask the Lord in prayer for rain indicates that there has been a concomitant spiritual restoration that occurs at the time of these blessings. Now, moving to verse 2, the prophet writes, "For the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners have seen a lie, and have told false dreams. They comfort in vain. Therefore, they went their way as a flock. They were troubled because there was no shepherd." Now, in contrast to the Lord, the true and only source of blessings, the idols have spoken vanity, and the diviners, or the soothsayers, have seen a lie, and they have told false dreams. This word, idols, is the Hebrew teraphim, And according to the NET translation, or the Net Bible Translation notes, it refers to small images used as means of divination and other occult practices. These were, and I quote, idols kept in the family rather than in a shrine and probably made in human form. The idols have spoken vanity. That is a broad reference to useless and powerless messages, likely encouraging iniquity. The diviners refer to those people who claim to have some supernatural power to interpret omens in order to predict the future. But just like the idols' empty messages, the diviners have seen a lie. They've misled the people through false dreams, and in fact, they tell the people what they want to hear. They comfort in vain, but the comfort they offer is empty. It's vain because it is rooted in false dreams and it's not rooted in God's truth. Now, in this environment where there was no shepherd, the people act like a confused flock of sheep, and they went their way and they were troubled. The false prophets and the teachers throughout history have led many people into sin and judgment. The problem is that people can reach a point where false teaching is what they actually want to hear. You see that, for example, in 2 Timothy chapter 4, verse 3. When the false teachers are dealt with, so are their followers. Zephaniah chapter 1, verses 4 to 6. Their idolatry is a result of having no shepherd or no leader, and this is a reference to an absent or bankrupt leadership. As one commentator, Dennett, comments, Israel then, in their unbelief, had turned to idols and their prophets to succor, but found no relief or comfort. And the prophet depicts them as going their way as a flock, in their disappointment, troubled, because there was no shepherd, none to lead and to tend them. And thus, since they had turned away from God, they were cast now in their sins upon their own resources. End of quote. Sadly, we know from the New Testament that this continues to be a problem in the first century. I would read to you from Matthew 9 and verse 36. But when he saw the multitudes, of course this speaks of Jesus seeing the multitudes, he was moved with compassion on them because they fainted and were scattered abroad as sheep having no shepherd. Let's move to verse 3. Mine anger was kindled against the shepherds, and I punished the goats, for the Lord of hosts hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and hath made them as his goodly horse in the battle. Speaking for God in the first person, the prophet Zechariah says, mine anger was kindled or burned against the faulty shepherds, and I punished the goats. The shepherds, no doubt, means the leaders, and it broadly refers to religious and political leaders. It may also refer to the false prophets as well. The term goats appears to refer to people among the flock of sheep of God. They are the ones who are not believers. It's notable in Ezekiel 34, verses 17 to 22, God says he will judge the flock and separate out the goats. The goats feed on the good pasture, but they trample the rest of your pastures with your feet, so that God says, my sheep must eat what you trampled with your feet and drink what you muddied with your feet. We also know in Matthew 25, verses 32 to 46, that Jesus spoke of a judgment on the sheep and the goats. So while the bad shepherds no doubt do some of the same evils as the goats are the wicked within the flock that bring harm to the sheep. And through the prophet Ezekiel, God says, and I quote, therefore will I save my flock, and they shall no more be a prey, and I will judge between the cattle and cattle, and I will set up one shepherd over them, and he shall feed them. Even my servant David, he shall feed them, and he shall be their shepherd. Ezekiel 34, 22 to 23. Here, the prophet Ezekiel looks forward to a future time associated with the coming Messiah, Jesus Christ. We see the same parallel in the next verse here in Zechariah, where the prophet will connect these events to the coming Messiah. Whereas on the one hand, bad shepherds had left the flock defenseless to wander, on the other hand, the Lord of hosts, or armies, hath visited his flock, the house of Judah, and he has made them as a goodly horse in the battle. God's visit to his people refers to his blessings on Judah, transforming them from wandering sheep with no shepherd to God's goodly horse in battle. These words indicate a trained horse of the highest quality, The God of armies metaphorically transforms this abandoned and defenseless flock of sheep into his powerful, goodly horse for battle to defeat Judah's enemies. This transformation is preparatory to battle, which Zechariah will expand on in the next verse. Notably, there's no indication that Judah deserves God's intervention on their behalf. The transformation is of grace. Now, moving to verse 4, the prophet writes, "Out of him came forth the corner, out of him the nail, out of him the battle bow, out of him every oppressor together." This is a challenging verse. Zechariah continues the thought of God transforming Judah into his battle horse to defeat Judah's enemies, explaining that out of him, that is, out of Judah, came forth the corner or the cornerstone. Out of him, again, Judah, the nail, and out of him, again, Judah, the battle bow. Out of him, every oppressor together. I agree with Charles Feinberg's interpretation, and I'll read what he says, quote, "We prefer to understand the cornerstone, the nail, and the battle bow of the Messiah, while the second clause presents the result of his activities," end of quote. You see, the term cornerstone is used in the Old Testament to designate leaders, and it is used specifically of the Messiah in Isaiah 28:16, Psalm 118:22, and in the New Testament, Luke 20, verse 17, 1 Corinthians 3:11, Ephesians 2:20, and 1 Peter 2, verse 6. We read in Isaiah 28:16, "Therefore thus saith the Lord God, behold, I will lay in Zion for a foundation, a stone, a tried stone, a precious cornerstone, a sure foundation. He that believeth shall not make haste," end of quote. As in the Isaiah passage, the cornerstone in view here is a good and proper shepherd, not like those that God judges in chapter 10, verse 3. In fact, the cornerstone is the King of Kings, the King presented in Zechariah 9, verse 9 to 10, Jesus Christ, who we know comes out of Judah. Now, as the cornerstone, he is the foundation to Israel's future kingdom. He is the moving agent for God's promises in chapter 10, verse 3, to make Judah his, quote, goodly horse in battle. But the picture here is not the lowly king that we met with in Zechariah 9, verse 9. This is not about the first coming. This is about the second coming. It reflects events that we see so vividly later in Zechariah 14 and again in Revelation 19. Zechariah continues with the language, "out of him," that is out of Judah, "the nail." The nail may refer to a peg on a wall. We see that in Ezekiel 15:3 and Isaiah 22, verses 22 to 24. It can also be used of a tent peg, as in Judges 4. Valuables were hung on pegs, and the pegs were used for tents. We may look again to Isaiah to help us understand this word peg in the context of a person. We find interpretive assistance in Isaiah 22, verses 15 to 25, and I won't read all of that. But there, Isaiah prophesied that Shebna, the treasurer, would be set aside from his position of honor, and Eliakim would assume the governmental responsibilities. To Eliakim, the son of Hilkiah, would be given great authority. And God says in Isaiah 22, verses 23 to 24, "I will fasten him as a nail," that's our word, "a nail in his sure place, and he shall be for a glorious throne to his father's house, and they shall hang upon him all the glory of his father's house." And so the term peg is really a metonymy for that which one hangs on the peg, and namely the honor and the glory of God himself. The Son of God, Jesus Christ, is that peg, and he has the very honor of the Father upon him. The battle bow refers to Messiah as a warrior, and it relates back to chapter 9, where the Messiah is seen as a conquering king. We read in Revelation 19:11 about Jesus, "And I saw heaven opened, and behold, a white horse, and he that sat upon him was called Faithful and True, and in righteousness he doth judge and make war." The term oppressor is an unusual word. It's used in Exodus 3:7 for the Egyptian taskmasters over their slaves. But here in Zechariah and through the work of Messiah, the Gentile oppressors will be removed from Judah. Let's move on to 5 through 7. "They shall be as mighty men which tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle, and they shall fight because the Lord is with them, and the riders on horses shall be confounded. And I will strengthen the house of Judah, and I will save the house of Joseph, and I will bring them again to place them. For I have mercy upon them, and they shall be as though I had not cast them off. For I am the Lord their God, and will hear them. And they of Ephraim shall be like a mighty man, and their heart shall rejoice as through wine. Yea, their children shall see it and be glad. Their heart shall rejoice in the Lord. As we have seen in chapter 9, verse 13, God will lead and empower an army of Jewish people from the nation of Judah to fight victoriously over the Gentile invaders during this tribulation period of time. This is elaborated here with Messiah, the cornerstone, the peg, the battle bow of chapter 10, verse 4, fighting with and through his army. It's Messiah who shall, and I'm reading from the text here, be as mighty men which tread down their enemies in the mire of the streets in the battle. Note that their enemies does not appear in the Hebrew text, and in most of the King James versions, it's written in italics to indicate that they've added that to the text. But this interpretive wording was added and it's put in italics. The point here, however, is that Judah will tread down the mire or mud of the streets in the battle. And the mire or the mud of the streets symbolizes their defeated enemies. We further read of Judah that they shall fight and prevail because the Lord is with them and not because of their own strength. Judah will so overcome her enemies that the riders on horses shall be confounded or confused. We're reminded from chapter 9, verse 10 of the promise that God would remove the chariots and the horses from the land. The picture here is of the infantry defeating the cavalry, confounding the riders on horses, which in the context of ancient warfare is quite unexpected. It's all because God is with them. We don't expect that men on foot can defeat the men who are riding the horses, but that's exactly what happens. We also read additional detail in Zechariah 14, verses 13 through 15, that God will confuse the invaders and even confuse their animals. Moreover, God will reunite the nation of Israel. After Solomon's rule, the kingdom split into two separate nations. Here, those separate nations are referred to as Judah, that's the southern kingdom, and Joseph, a reference to Ephraim or the northern kingdom. God will strengthen the house of Judah. He will save the house of Joseph, and he will bring them again to place them, that is to unite them together. In other words, they will both be put back into the Holy Land, another reference to the regathering of the Jewish people. This is how God will show mercy upon them. But there's more than physical deliverance and victory here. We read in the text, they shall be as though I had not cast them off in the first place. The healing will be so complete that it will be as if they were never exiled. But that is only possible if their iniquity is removed. You can see all about that in Zechariah chapter 5, covered in a prior lesson. To that end, that is a spiritual restoration, God says, for I am the Lord their God and will hear their prayers. This indicates a restored relationship. The prophet Zechariah focuses again on this future restoration. In chapter 13, verse 9, where we read, and I will bring the third part through the fire, and will refine them as silver is refined, and will try them as gold is tried. They shall call on my name, and I will hear them. I will say it is my people, and they shall say the Lord is my God. Now, in verse 7 here in chapter 10, Ephraim refers to the northern kingdom, which is the same as referring to Joseph. And before Zechariah's time, the northern kingdom was defeated and scattered by the Assyrians in approximately 722 BC. In the future, when Messiah comes, the northern kingdom shall be like a mighty man or a hero heading into battle, and their affliction will be reversed so that their heart shall rejoice as through wine. This echoes the imagery of rejoicing and prosperity of the young men and women in chapter 9, verse 17, at the end of that chapter. And it is not a temporary rejoicing. Zechariah adds that their children shall see their reversal of fortune and rejoice, and as a result, the children will also be glad. This is consistent with other prophetic passages that speak of rejoicing in connection with God's future deliverance of his people. Isaiah 25:9, Isaiah 65:13, Zephaniah 3:14. Now, once again, we observe that their restoration includes a spiritual restoration, so that while in the past they would have rejoiced in the idols and the diviners, we saw that back in verse 3, now they will give God the credit and rejoice in the Lord. Verse 8, God says, I will hiss for them and gather them, for I have redeemed them, and they shall increase as they have increased. Continuing the imagery of the good shepherd gathering his flock together, we saw that in 9:16 and 10:3. God will hiss for his people scattered abroad and gather them. The word hiss means to whistle. It pictures God like a shepherd who is summoning his sheep home, just as a shepherd would summon their flock. They whistle and the flock recognize the sound of their shepherd and no other. This regathering begins with God's whistle, which will be responded to because he already redeemed or ransomed them. The term redeemed is the word for purchasing from slavery and captivity. Their spiritual redemption precedes their physical restoration in the land. The prophet Isaiah pronounced the same truth about the future redemption and regathering in Isaiah 35:10, which says, "And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with songs and everlasting joy upon their heads. They shall obtain joy and gladness, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away." So the prophet Jeremiah similarly said, and I'm reading from Jeremiah 31, verses 10 to 11, "Hear the word of the Lord, O you nations, and declare it in the isles," or islands, "afar off, and say, He that scattered Israel will gather them and keep them as a shepherd doth his flock. For the Lord hath redeemed Jacob and ransomed him from the hand of him that was stronger than he." So this redemption, of course, will happen as a future generation of Israel turns to Jesus. Matthew 23, verse 39, listen to what Jesus said, "For I say unto you, you shall not see me henceforth, so you shall say, Blessed is he that cometh in the name of the Lord." And so that's all made possible by the coming king, whose triumphal entry to address their sins was presented in Zechariah 9. Israel's future redemption will be coupled with its multiplication. That is, God will increase them. And this is a common prophetic theme. Isaiah 54:2, Ezekiel 36:10, Hosea 1:10, Micah 2:12. Even in the diaspora, God would increase or multiply his people. And then when they return to the Holy Land, they will continue to increase or multiply. We cannot help but see the parallel with Israel growing as a nation while they were in bondage in Egypt, followed by this tremendous exodus from bondage to the promised land. The dispersion is a sort of a new Egypt for God's people, but what is witnessed with the small return of people in Zechariah's day is yet just a foretaste of a future new exodus under God's blessing and protection. The prophet Haggai, who ministered at the same time as Zechariah, encouraged the people by likening God's promise that he is with them to his promises to the nation generations earlier during the exodus from Egypt. You can read about that in Haggai chapter 2, verses 4 to 5. But the verse at hand looks at a future global exodus when God calls them home. Let's move to verse 9. "I will sow them among the people, and they shall remember me in far countries, and they shall live with their children and turn again." So continuing to build on this future global exodus from the Gentile nations back to the Holy Land, Zechariah speaks for God in proclaiming that he will sow them among the people or nations, but in the future they will remember me in far countries. Note that "sow" is not the word for scatter that some translations take it to be. It is "so" as in sowing seeds. You see, God is pictured here not as the one that scattered Israel, but rather that they are sown abroad as seeds to grow, to multiply, to prosper as a crop in these distant countries. And indeed, during the dispersion, the people shall live with their children, indicating that God will multiply them as he multiplied the nation in Egypt. Then, at some future point, the people will turn again, meaning that they are going to return to the land of Israel. The promised regathering will be a response to the Jewish people remembering God. God writes in this text, in verse 9, "They will remember me," indicating a spiritual return, a spiritual turning to him. This points to a future spiritual revival, which will be addressed in detail in Zechariah 12. But even in the first century, in the ministries of John the Baptist and Jesus, They preach repentance because the kingdom is at hand. For example, Matthew 4, verse 17. That generation did not remember God, but a future one will. Next, verses 10 and 11. I will bring them also again out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria. I will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon and place them, and place shall not be found for them. And he shall pass through the sea with affliction and shall smite the waves in the sea, and all the deeps of the river shall dry up. And the pride of Assyria shall be brought down, and the scepter of Egypt shall depart away. So as Zechariah notes in verse 8, God summons his people from the Gentile nations as a shepherd calls his sheep. It says there that he hisses for them, and God has multiplied his people, and eventually they will remember him in the far countries, and they will return. That was verse 9. So continuing that thought, God now says through the prophet Zechariah, I will bring them again to also out of the land of Egypt and gather them out of Assyria. Of course, both of these countries were long-time enemies of God's people, with them in bondage to Egypt early in their history and some portion of them in bondage to Assyria much later. It's also to be observed that Assyria was a kingdom encompassing a large geographic area. There's debate whether Zechariah means literally the nations of Egypt and Assyria, or uses these as representative examples of all God's all the Gentile nations where God has sown his people. But regardless of how you determine this narrow issue, the tenor of the passage as a whole is a complete, total return from the Gentile nations. In fact, God will bring them into the land of Gilead and Lebanon. Gilead does not always have the same meaning. Here, it's the rugged highland area cut by river valleys and bordered by Bashan to the north, Moab to the south, Ammon to the east, Jordan River to the west. Given the context of a greatly multiplied nation of people returning to the promised land, we should take Gilead in its broadest sense. It really is a reference for most of the Holy Land, and the region of Lebanon borders what we usually think of as Israel on the north. So we must bear in mind that Israel never achieved the borders originally promised to it, and the Israel of today, of course, is much smaller than what God promised. But what is in view here in the future return to the land is a multiplied people that fill the nation's originally intended borders that we read about in Deuteronomy chapter 1, verses 7 to 8. There we read that basically it's the land from the Nile River to the Euphrates River. So the reader should also carefully review Deuteronomy 29 as well as Deuteronomy 30 verses 1 to 10 for additional background there. Now, bringing his people to Gilead and Lebanon is a reference to fulfilling the promise of Israel's borders that had never been previously achieved. Expositor David Barron notes this probably represents the whole promised land east and west of the Jordan. Now, in fact, the prophet Zechariah adds, and place shall not be found for them, suggesting that the promised land is simply not big enough to contain all the people. This may be hyperbole to emphasize the large population that will return. We're reminded at once of the promise in Zechariah 2 of a restored Jerusalem that cannot contain the population and therefore is, and I quote the language from chapter 2, verse 4, inhabited as towns without walls for the multitude. Now, drawing on the Exodus imagery, Zechariah says that God shall pass through the sea with affliction and shall smite the waves in the sea, and all the deeps of the rivers shall dry up. We at once remember God leading his people out of Egypt through the Red Sea, pushing back the waves to make an open path for his people to walk on dry land. As God summons his sheep home, he will once again make a way for them so that they may figuratively, so to say, walk on dry land. That is, in other words, he will remove the obstacles to their physical regathering to the promised land. The deeps of the river, meaning the Nile River, shall dry up, just as the Jordan River did before the Ark of the Covenant. We read that the pride of Assyria, that is, the northern kingdom's enemy to the north, shall be brought down or humbled in defeat, and the scepter or domination of Egypt, Israel's enemy to the south, shall depart away. By implication, all of Israel's enemies are dealt with. As God takes out the enemies, he clears a safe path for a return home. At this time, those Gentiles left among the nations will no longer be opposed to the Jewish people. We read that explicitly in Zechariah 14, verse 16. Now moving to verse 12, and I will strengthen them in the Lord, and they shall walk up and down in his name, saith the Lord. The chapter closes with God's promise that he will strengthen Israel in the Lord, enabling their safe return to the promised land, and when they return home, they shall walk up and down in his name. This concept of walking up and down in the land symbolizes an exercise of dominion over the land that had previously eluded them. This promise of blessing speaks not only of physical blessing, but spiritual blessing as well. The climax of this history, future, is God's redeemed people in the land he promised to Abraham so many years ago, under the leadership of the coming King and Messiah, Jesus Christ. As Jesus would say in the Olivet Discourse, speaking to the time of the tribulation, which we're looking at here in Zechariah 10, Jesus said, "And he shall send his angels with a great sound of a trumpet, and they shall gather together his elect from the four winds, from one end of heaven to the other," Matthew 24:31. That is a reference in Jesus' own teaching to gathering the redeemed Jewish people to the Holy Land. Now, as an aside, I note that in relatively recent history, 1948, Israel was politically restored as a sovereign nation. It regained some of the land within its ancient boundaries, and some Jewish people returned to Israel. This was not in fulfillment of Zechariah 10 and other passages foreseeing the future regathering of the promised land because, for a few reasons. First, Israel does not have all the land that was promised. Number two, the promises are to take place specifically during the day of the Lord or the tribulation. And three, the modest return to Israel so far was not a return in belief. That is, it wasn't coupled with a spiritual revival based on accepting the Lord Jesus Christ as Messiah. In closing, Israel is the prodigal nation that in the time of Zechariah 10 experiences a spiritual revival and then is welcomed home and with God's blessing. It is looking to the future. Zechariah prophesied it back in chapter 10 all these centuries ago. You know, as Christians, we sometimes come to a point in our lives where for a prolonged time, we're not where we're supposed to be in terms of our walk with the Lord. A lot of poor choices and perhaps events, some of which were our own fault and some of which were outside of our control, may contribute to how we find ourselves where we are today. But regardless of the path that we may have taken away from God, the result is that we're in a bad place spiritually and emotionally, and we can't fix it ourselves. If the new Exodus of Zechariah 10 about this glorious future return of the Jewish people to the land, if it says anything to us today in this moment when you're hearing this lesson on this audio recording, it says that nothing you can do and nothing I can do can put us so far beyond a God that we are beyond the reach of his promises. After centuries of disobedience, God will welcome the Jewish people home. And so it is for Christians who, through choices and circumstances, find themselves in a place that seems like exile from the joy of the Lord. If we will but turn to the Lord and seek his face and pray for the latter rain, we will find ourselves welcome back in the fellowship. Well, a couple of application points as we close out. First, the main principle, a combination of Israel's idolatry and poor leadership leads to the dispersion among the nations, but God, as their shepherd, will summon his flock back to the promised land, and through the coming Messiah, at his second advent, will enable them to overcome all of their enemies. Second principle, there must be a spiritual revival but before Israel will experience God's promised material blessings. And I will say to you, for you and I, when we find ourselves in that bad place and circumstances are bad, and we want to see circumstances change, the Bible never promises that all those circumstances will change. But one thing that's certain, there has to be a spiritual revival in our heart before we will see the physical things, the material things begin to change. And so that's a critical principle for us. Well, with that, I hope you'll stay with us for the rest of the series as we continue through this challenging but rewarding book that just doesn't get taught enough, and it's so important to our understanding end time stuff. Hope you'll continue with us. I hope if you've missed prior lessons, you'll go back and take a listen to those. And in the meantime, may God richly bless you. Thank you.